The Guardian.
Hello everybody, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, crisis at Chelsea. How long until Conte gets his payoff? The FA Cup replay, Swansea hit 8, Spurs through and Rochdale play on a sandpit. Elsewhere, the New England kit featuring anti-cling nodes, high-quality VAR from Portugal, West Ham getting older, and your questions, feedback corner, and that's today's Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian. Simon Burnton, hello.
Hi.
Since you were last on, you've had a lot of internet traffic about not drinking any tea. How have you found it?
Well, I think the intransigence of the tea drinkers, you know, has been the surprising thing. They don't understand that some people might not think like they do.
Have you had more abuse
real
from this?
Incredulity. So it's like, oh, so you don't drink tea, but do you drink iced tea? No, of course I don't drink iced tea. Again, iced tea doesn't smell bad like tea does, but that's only because it's cold. If it was hot, if someone heated the iced tea, it would be just as smelly as tea. In fact, it would be tea. So no, I don't drink iced tea. Why even ask?
Before we came on air, Simon described tea as tea itself or the tea drinkers as deviant.
Well, I mean, I've got no issue with tea. I'm happy for it to grow in its native environment. It can grow happily. No problem.
Jacob, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. Any views on tea?
I don't drink it, but I don't have such strong views as Simon does on it.
Okay. Barry, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
A few people said we had too much fun on Monday.
Yeah.
I'm worried we've started having a bit of fun already.
We haven't spoken about football yet. How dare you?
Watford 4, Chelsea 1. Let's start with, I know it was on Monday, but it's been bumbling on for a while now, the crisis of Antonio Conte. You were at the game, Simon.
I was.
Did you have a nice time?
I had a really good time. I mean, it was it was up there with my favourite games, I think, in the top 10 of favourite games I've seen.
Of all time?
Probably.
Watford?
Yeah, yeah.
All games?
Right. Well, let's say Watford games. Hmm. There are other games, and they're like a different species.
Yes. To be clear, anyone who doesn't know you're a Watford fan, you are a Watford fan.
I am a Watford fan. I was there as a Watford fan.
Okay. So did you see the Chelsea players, I don't want to make it just about Chelsea, but it's probably a bigger story, not trying for their manager, or was this just Watford's brilliance?
Well, Watford's pressing in midfield was extremely intense and worried from the start. We were in control in the first half hour, even before we went down to 11 men, when the extra player we had in a Chelsea shirt was sent off. Well, I mean, he was part of the problem because he gave the ball away so regularly. But, I mean, so did everyone else in that period.
Jacob Garman has been in touch on Twitter, Jacob Steinberg, to say, is Bakayoko's performance for Watford the worst Premier League performance by a single player since Jonathan Walters' 2 own goals and a missed penalty cameo in 2013?
I think that we can probably get a little bit overblown about what the worst performance ever is. Usually if it's a sort of a top six player who does a bit badly, then their performances get overrated to such an extent that we forget there are players lower down the league who are probably delivering those kind of performances on a much more regular basis, but maybe not seen as much by the viewing public. But Bakayoko has been a huge problem for Chelsea this season. Probably one of the players who Conte did not have a problem with them signing, but he's had a real struggle to fit into that side. I remember being with Conte in August when he was actually talking quite effusively about Bakayoko in a way that you might never hear him talk about Ross Barkley. And it was either before or after the Spurs game, which they won at Wembley, and Bakayoko was actually very good in that game, and he came into that with having had a knee injury and not played any football in pre-season, and looked like a dominant force in central midfield for Chelsea. And Conte was saying, yeah, he'll take a bit of time to adapt and everything, and he'll understand our football, and when he does, he's going to be great. But there's no sign of that really happening. I think maybe that one moment where he had a really good game in the win over Manchester United in November, where he was kind of rampaging through midfield and they couldn't pin him down, was one of the few high points for Bakayoko. But other than that, he's really struggling, and he's become a bit of a figure of fun for the Chelsea fans, who kind of looked like they had taken to him at the start of his career. But he was so good for Monaco last season. He was in this fantastic side that got to the semi-finals of the Champions League. He was one of the best players, and it was seen as a huge blow for them to lose him. So although he's getting a lot of stick at the moment, you do wonder how much this actually reflects on poorly on Chelsea rather than the individual himself.
And actually, players have been written off before in their first season, and sometimes it just takes a bit of time.
Yeah, he's clearly a good player. It wasn't a mistake to buy him. And is it the constraints that are being put on him by Antonio Conte that are leading him to play badly, like, say, to a lesser extent, occasionally happens, Paul Pogba? It's hard to know. And, you know, there's always, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes in his personal life, whatever. There could be all sorts of turmoil there. There may be none. We just don't know. But he hasn't settled. It's been surprising how poor he is. But it would, I'd say, be very unfair to scapegoat him for Chelsea's defeat on Monday, even if, you know, the joke was that when he went off, they improved as a side because he was playing so badly.
The shame was that Nathaniel Chalobah, who was elbowed out of Chelsea to make way for him, was, through injury, not there. It would have been a really, I don't know, it would have felt like more of a moment had he been on the pitch in a Watford shirt while Bakayoko was being humiliated. And, you know, the Bakayoko's two bookings were both a result of apparent technical, simple lack of technical ability, an inability to control the ball and keep it under his control. And he was abused off the pitch by the Chelsea fans. And, I mean, it just looked like a very, very dark situation for him.
Chelsea are fourth in the league, Jacob. They're still in the Champions League. They're still in the FA Cup. But is it this week's crisis, or is this a deep inset crisis?
They've been in this position before, and they've sacked two managers in February previously under Roman Abramovich, who doesn't really take too much of a positive view on these slight dips in form 6 months after winning the title. Scolari went in February in 2009, and of course the most recent example, BVS Boas, going in between the Champions League last 16 legs, the first leg against Napoli, which was lost 3-1 in 2012, and he was sent on his way shortly after that. And Di Matteo came in on that caretaker basis and won the Champions League. So if they're looking for a historical precedent, then perhaps that's it. Perhaps we'll see them lose quite badly to Barcelona in the first leg and Conte go, and then Hiddink come in or something like that, and lead them to the Champions League, and having finished fifth or sixth or something like that. And but I think overall it's looking like it's coming to an end for Conte. I think, you know, Don Fifield, who has obviously knows his stuff about Chelsea, one of our correspondents at The Guardian, says it's when rather than if he goes. And with Conte, it's kind of been bubbling away since the summer.
And he'll just hang around till a payoff, really.
He looks like he's sort of in that Mourinho mode of getting them to sack him at this point. And, you know, why weren't they, you know, he's making the statements, why weren't they back me in public? And he's slagging off the signings, and he's saying that he has no kind of say over who comes in, which you do wonder when he, you know, they have players from Italy who are being signed. You would think that Conte would know who they are, having been the manager of Italy not so long ago, and the manager of Juventus. But he keeps doing this, and it just doesn't seem like it's the way to go with a owner like Abramovich. And also they've got other powerful people there, like Marina Granovskaya as well.
I mean, Conte is a very wealthy man. He has the air about him of someone who's D-mob happy, would quite like to be sacked. That's the impression I get. And, you know, I'm reading articles, people saying that he should be given a chance to turn things around. I don't think he wants a chance to turn things around. Short of donning a sandwich board with "sack me" written on it, and you know, walking up and down outside Stamford Bridge ringing a bell. I'm not sure how he could make it any more clear that he would like to be relieved of his position.
Do you think Chelsea fans care? Because you know, they've won 5 league titles, 4 FA Cups, 3 League Cups, the Champions League, and the Europa League since I think basically since 2004. No Chelsea manager since Jose the second time around has lasted more than 2 seasons. As a neutral, it makes me love them less, right? It makes me go, it's just this sort of weird treadmill production line.
The names that are being linked are, well, the big name that's being linked at the moment is Luis Enrique, and there's no major evidence to suggest that he's as good a manager as Conte, although he's won the Champions League. But he did win the Champions League with Messi, Suarez, Neymar up front. And then it kind of all went south at Barcelona the following 2 seasons after that, and he was sent. He was sacked. But he's saying at the moment as well that he doesn't want to take it until the end of the season. So you'd imagine it would have to be, if they sack Conte now, it would have to be another caretaker. And you kind of think that Chelsea are almost running out of names. At what point are they going to come back to who they've already had? And you know, Ancelotti's available. Could it be him? He's been linked already this season and everything. And they would argue that having sacked all these managers, it has an effect, and they win a title. That, you know, Conte, Mourinho was sacked 6 months after winning the league, but Conte came in and revived them, sparked a tactical revolution in England, won it at Canter. And then he'll go, and someone will do that. I think the worry for Chelsea probably be at this moment is that they're not spending on a same level at the moment as the Manchester clubs, and I think that's a lot of where their problems are coming at the moment.
Yeah, I just wonder if Chelsea fans want to be part of a project, or if that's just a word that should never be used. If they look at teams that don't win titles, like Klopp's Liverpool or Pochettino's Spurs, and they see there's a thing, this sort of big thing that's building, but you'd rather win stuff, wouldn't you?
I don't think any Chelsea fan who was in Munich on the 19th of May 2012 was thinking, I wish we were a bit more like Pochettino's.
You're probably right.
Spurs.
Simon, Troy Deeney celebrated in excitable fashion with his middle finger. No ban. The 3-man panel of ex-referees were not unanimous over whether it was a red card offence. No disciplinary action will be taken. What's up with Troy?
Yeah, it was puzzling and worrying. I don't think anyone in the ground really saw it. I think it happened for an instant. Even on television, no one caught it at the time. But he's an experienced player now. He's the captain of the team and should be above such childish displays of petulance. So he says it was a reaction to that. Scoring the goal felt to him like a declaration that after a month in January, when he was linked with moves away and some fans speculated that it might be a good time to sell him and maybe he's kind of fading, he scored a goal and he felt that he'd proved that he was still relevant and still present. And so the finger was a response to that situation. But really, grow up. And he's already been banned twice this season. Once for a crazy tackle in an irrelevant part of the pitch, and once for trying to squeeze Jalen's head till it popped. And he doesn't need to risk further bans for nothing, for idiocy.
Speaking of growing up, Richarlison was subbed at 1-0 and was in floods of tears on the bench. He says, I was crying because I wanted to play and help my teammates. But in the end, the guy that entered the pitch did the job well, so it's all okay. Is that a sign of great passion?
It's slightly odd behaviour from... I know he's quite young, but he's a legally an adult. But if, you know, that's how he felt, let it out. Yeah, why not cry?
Are you a crier, Barry?
Not really. I'm a bit like yourself. I'll cry at watching neighbours, and you know, or a sad YouTube video of a Labrador licking a poorly child's face or something. But in real life, not so much. No. Occasionally, I have my moments.
Watford go to West Ham on Saturday. Chelsea, as you say, play West Brom on Monday night. Wayne Rooney was doing Monday Night Football. It seems to do well, according to social media, which is the barometer of everything. Did anyone see and want to analyse his performance?
I thought it was accomplished. I'm not sure why everyone's so shocked at it. I thought his broadcasting chops seemed quite well honed. He didn't do that thing I always do where I go when I'm between trying to think of the next thing I'm going to say.
There were no like 2 minute pauses.
Well, a pause is okay. It's when you feel the need to fill it with an Daryl Breen's good at that as well. Maybe it's an Irish thing. But, you know, he's played a hell of a lot of football at a very high level. He's very knowledgeable. He gave some very interesting insights. And I wasn't hugely surprised. You know, Wayne's not as thick as people like to make him out to be, some people. And he'd clearly been given a lot of help. I thought he started, he was quite nervous, but Jamie Carragher helped him out. And it reminded me of a story, actually, Paul McGrath told once, where he was invited on RT to be a pundit and was incredibly nervous because he's very self-conscious, very shy, doesn't like being on camera. And he said during a break they were discussing, you know, what they'd be talking about next, and he couldn't think of a single opinion to have on whatever topic it was. So John Giles, who was alongside him, said, look, why don't you say this, and fed him a line. And then they came back from the break and Paul McGrath was asked his question and he just gave the line, and then John Giles bounced off it, you know. So I think Jamie Carragher was similarly helpful and supportive at the start when Wayne was quite clearly nervous, but he grew into it and was very good. I mean, I've spent the day out there at Sky when they do Monday Night Football, and they start very early in the morning. You know, they, I think, gather there around, when I was there, it was Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher and Ed Chamberlain, and they convened in the office at about 9:30 in the morning. So they do rehearsals and all that. So that was probably helpful as well, for assuming Wayne was there all day.
They started very early on with discussing Everton Arsenal, and Rooney had strong opinions on that he wasn't afraid to voice. And I think that kind of settled everything for both the viewers and for him, maybe. The fear when current players are on as pundits is that they are kind of silenced by politics, by a fear of upsetting their people they still work with. And the fact that Rooney spoke quite frankly, criticised his teammates' performance at the weekend, and he could hardly fail to do so. But
did he say, can we get Marco Silva? He didn't go that far.
He didn't go that far, no. But he said he was on the bench at Arsenal, and he had felt embarrassed that at halftime he had addressed his teammates and told them that he had been embarrassed watching them and they need to back up their ideas. And it was interesting to hear him speak so strongly and him revealing that he gives halftime team talks or contributes to the, you know, speaks at halftime to his team. And that was a good start for him.
The FA Cup replays this week, okay, Spurs beat Newport and Swansea beat Notts County. Rochdale Millwall was a bit of an upset. Do you think we should just get rid of the replays? I mean, there are so many games, it would be a good chance to miss the games. Or is it, if you look at Newport, they made a lot of money out of this, there's a place for them?
I think there's arguments in favour of them and against them. I think it's unfair on smaller clubs like Newport or Rochdale or whoever to get rid of them. And not everything should pander towards, you know, Premier League clubs with more important things to do, in inverted commas. So, but I can also see the appeal of just settling it over one game, penalties if needed. It gives... still gives the Minnows an equal chance of winning the tie, so probably a better chance. Newport never had a prayer of beating Spurs at Wembley, I would say, whereas I would have given them an excellent chance of beating them on penalties at Rodney Parade. So, as Mike Tyson famously said once, there are pros and cons for and pros and cons against.
And he, of all the men to live your life by, I believe Mike Tyson is the one. For Spurs, Jacob, their squad is now fully fit. I think for the North London derby coming up, Alderweireld played a full game. Lamella looked excellent. And that's good news for them. And talking about, you know, the Spurs project needing a trophy, they've got Rochdale in the next round. They've got to start looking at this and thinking, we could win this without having to play anybody who's any good.
Yeah, and Pochettino hates being told that, and he hasn't placed that high a value on the cups. But I don't necessarily agree with him on that, because I do sometimes think that a cup just give you a bit more of a winning mentality. You know, the classic example would be going back to Mourinho in his first spell at Chelsea, the high emphasis he placed on the League Cup with a squad that actually hadn't done anything up until that point. And they won that, and then obviously continued steamrolling their way to the title and almost won the Champions League that year. I think that this Tottenham team could do with something like that. I think just as a club, they could do with something like this. It's been a, you know, they see themselves as a big club, and but it's been 10 years now since they've won a major trophy, beating Chelsea in the League Cup final. And they do have a really good chance. And I think that obviously Alderweireld coming back is a huge positive for them. I think they've missed him quite a lot. His ability to pass out from the back, I think, has been missed. Not sure they've got people who are necessarily of the same quality. If you think back to the Champions, the Europa League final last season, the way that Mourinho targeted Davinson Sanchez's, you know, his ability in possession wasn't quite as high as his fellow centre back, and I think that's been a little bit of a problem for Spurs. And I think it was seen in that game when they played again, when they lost at the Emirates in November, which was one of the first games they didn't have Alderweireld in, and he played three at the back that day as well, and it didn't quite work out. But I think with Alderweireld being back, it's going to work in a much better way for them.
Spurs, how will Spurs' slick passing game work on the Spotland pitch, Simon, which was absolutely glorious to see, the sand pit of Rochdale?
Well, I mean, it'll be uncomfortable, as it should be. This is what the FA Cup is all about, isn't it? So we're big clubs playing away at small grounds with uncomfortable changing rooms and rubbish pitches. Yeah, hopefully they'll find it very hard.
Well, they certainly didn't acquit themselves very well at Rodney Parade, you know, so...
Yep.
But they'll hardly be allowed to be that complacent again. Or I'm not even sure it was complacency. It's as if they considered it beneath them, you know, and I would imagine Pochettino will buck their ideas up ahead of any game at Spotland. If we briefly go back to what Jacob was saying about Pochettino not putting much store in the cups, I just find this lack of reverence for the FA Cup astonishing, because when I was a kid, that's you dreamed of winning the FA Cup, not the league, not the European Cup, certainly not coming fourth in the league. The FA Cup was the be-all and end-all of life, as far as me and my mates were concerned anyway. I don't know if it's a similar thing here or it's a generational thing.
I think if I put myself in the same generation as you, Barry, which I'm loath to do, the fact that English clubs weren't in Europe for a very seminal part of my youth gave the FA Cup a cachet that it maybe wouldn't have had if the English clubs were in Europe. I don't know if...
Well, also, the Champions agree? League, there was only one club in the European Cup back in the day. So the FA Cup was one of the only trophies that you could win. And now you've got five English teams in there this season.
And it was one of few televised games. There was a long period in history, I guess before European competition, when the FA Cup final and England's annual international fixture against Scotland were the two big games of the season. And then after, when European football came in, when there were only a handful of live matches a season and the FA Cup final was taken terribly seriously, and now we're just flooded with football, so and with competitions, and I guess the financial benefit of for every league position in the Premier League and of finishing in the top four, all of it dilutes the importance of the FA Cup, and there's no getting that back
unless you give it a Champions League space.
But why would you?
To make it people really want to win it.
But what's the achievement?
The
achievement is not equivalent to the reward.
I mean, I totally agree. It's a commensurate.
If Spurs get there, they'll have to, and they win the FA Cup this season, let's say they finish fifth, they'll have beaten a load of lower league sides to get, and then they will play two games. It won't be equivalent to Arsenal winning the Europa League.
No, I completely agree with you, but it would... I'd completely agree with you.
There's no way to do it. So it means that there's just for the modern manager, it's just not that much of a reward, and it doesn't necessarily protect you from being sacked. If you finish fifth and win the FA Cup and you don't win the Europa League, if that happens to be the competition you're in, you won't be in the money spinning competition next year. So you won't have anything to.
Yeah, I still agree.
And there's only one club. There's only one club where that's acceptable in that top six. Where the manager's been there for 20 years.
On that TV thing, it was Terry Gibson on the wireless, wasn't it, Barry, who said the FA Cup semi-final, Wimbledon semi-final...
against Luton.
...was not on telly. When was that, 88? Amazing? Yeah. It just wasn't on TV. Like, can you imagine an FA Cup semi-final not being on TV? Swansea scored 8 against Notts County. Carlos Carvajal has seen a run now of only 1 defeat in 10 matches. And this is Swansea's record victory in the FA Cup and their highest domestic win since 1978. He now plays his former team Sheffield Wednesday at Hillsborough in the next round. And Huddersfield are through. They beat Birmingham 4-1 after extra time. Play Manchester United in the fifth round as well. The draw for the fifth round, it's not that exciting, but it could lead to quite big semi-finals and final. If you think Leicester, Sheffield United, Chelsea, Hull, Sheffield Wednesday, Swansea, Brighton, Coventry, West Brom, Southampton, Huddersfield, Manchester United, Rochdale, Spurs, and Wigan v Manchester City. And that'll do for part one. And we'll be back in a sec. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Some football admin, chaps. The winter break talks are ongoing to introduce one from the 2019-2020 season onwards, ahead of the new TV deal, which is this month sometime, isn't it? It wouldn't impact on the festive schedule, so I think they'll do it after Christmas. Do you want one, Barry?
I wouldn't be against it. I think players could do with a break. Fans could probably do with a break, you know, have a couple of weeks off and just reacquaint yourself with your family and catch up on your Netflix and all that. But my concern would be that, and it's not even much of a concern, I just think that clubs would use it to send their players off on tours, money-making tours to far-flung destinations, which kind of negates the whole point of having the break in the first place, but it's not going to affect my life particularly, and that's all that matters, really.
Today's Times suggest that what they're looking at is a staggered break. So not every team would be off at the same time, and there would be no blank weekends with no Premier League football.
Okay.
So that might be the best of all worlds.
Is that to placate TV companies? Presumably?
I'm sure it is, yeah. I'm sure. But like they're talking about bringing this in for the, 2018-19 season?
19-20, I think.
And they've already sold the rights for that season?
Oh, okay.
Anyway... certainly, the TV companies wouldn't want to have a couple of barren weeks in the middle of winter.
That's sad if you're friends with another footballer at a different team and you can't go on like a couple's holiday because they've got a game and you don't have a game.
Yes.
They should get themselves, do what Kevin Nolan used to do, get himself suspended for Christmas. Or
Kevin Nolan told me a story that when he went from Bolton to Newcastle, he booked a... he booked a holiday for Mrs. Nolan and her friends, and either as he was leaving the house or as she was leaving, he just shouted down the stairs, "I've just signed for Newcastle!" And then she had a holiday to deal with the fact that her, basically she was moving from the middle of the country to the top of the country, and had a nice holiday.
And she also, through that move, then ended up with a nice tenant.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Big Andy.
Big and Andy's, and then, as the car switches on, and Andy's moving in.
Blimey.
But I mean, the thing is, most clubs get a winter break anyway because the FA Cup generally sees to that. You know, an awful lot of Premier League sides get 10 days to a fortnight off on the back of an early cup exit.
And actually, surely this would create some congestion somewhere else. I mean, how in Europe, they all have it in Europe. How do they all manage it?
Well, they don't. Well,
they have fewer teams.
Some don't have the league, the equivalent of the League Cup.
Is that right? And they're talking about maybe doing away with FA Cup replays from the fifth round onwards. So that would allow one more midweek round of Premier League fixtures.
Okay. I'm just thinking about whether it's... Do we think it would...
If there was a winter break, we would have to do more three-hour-long radio shows, and I don't want that. So that I've now changed my tune. I am against the winter break.
Do you think it would... But I would go away. So you'd have to do them on your own. But do you think it would increase England's chances of winning a World Cup or a European Championship or not?
No.
Because?
Because there are lots of foreigners in England, so they would get the same kind of benefit, wouldn't they?
Would England...
Would we have to make the foreign players play? Should be just.
Would England players spend the winter break practicing really hard to try and get as good as many of their foreign counterparts who do win World Cups?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it would at least allow us to cross one thing off our list of excuses.
That's it.
And would therefore bring us a step closer to the actual answer. So if we've crossed off, we're tired because we don't have a winter break and everyone else does, then we'd be left with, it's a bit hot and we're not used to it, which is our other big World Cup fallback option.
Yes.
And
we're no good at penalties.
Yeah, and that may persist.
And we're still playing 11-a-side on full-size pitches from under sevens up. So we'd have to solve those three.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, we win it this year.
Yeah, that would really... Put the cat amongst the pigeons.
In our brand new kit. Have you all seen the New England kit? How do we feel about it? Does it give you hope?
I haven't seen it. Does it have wicking?
Does it have what?
Wicking.
What's wicking?
They all wick.
They all wick.
Everybody wicks these days.
What is that?
It's where when you sweat, the wicking takes it away from your skin, I think, and absorbs it.
Ah, well, I've got the guff, if you want to hear the PR guff about the New England kit. The home shirt is white and the away shirt is red, as you'd imagine. And they're quite plain. I quite like them. A red trim around the collar that weaves into a St. George's cross stands out. There is a traditional blue piping around the Three Lions insignia with a silver star above the motif to symbolise England's one and only World Cup triumph. The strip also features a rosette on the inside of the shirt and custom typeface used for player names. Player numbers, backed by anti-cling nodes to stop the shirt sticking in extreme heat, have been moved from the centre of the shirt to a more breathable zone below the crest. How do we feel about that?
It looks nice. I'm looking at a picture of Raheem Sterling here.
No names. So I think the full impact of the moving of those numbers and the bespoke font for the names remains to be seen. But the shirts themselves are classic and restrained and pleasant. So, thumbs up.
How much does it cost?
We don't know
yet. To those of us who aren't lucky enough to get picked to play in the team and get a free shirt?
Could you qualify?
No, okay. I'm not qualified to play for England.
Okay. Otherwise, you would be...
Oh, I'd be champing at the bit, yeah.
In other international news, Barry, Wes Houlihan has retired from the Republic of Ireland duty. 43 appearances, only one major tournament, Euro 2016. Scored the equaliser against Sweden, set up Robbie Brady's goal that took Ireland to the last 16. But not loved. He was a Marmite footballer, wasn't he?
I think everyone in the Republic of Ireland thinks very highly of Wesley. Giovanni Trapattoni certainly didn't. He never used him because he couldn't be trusted to do what he was told. I think sometimes he's certainly the most skillful player Ireland have had in a very long time. But producer Mel, who's a Norwich fan and a big Wesley fan, was telling me this morning, I hadn't realised this. There was, I think, a four-year gap between his first call-up and his second, or his first appearance and his second for Ireland. And he never really got going until he was well into his, past the age of 25. So everyone appreciates his contribution. I think sometimes it may have been exaggerated how effective he was, but it seems to be a thoroughly lovely bloke and a good footballer and probably should have had a lot more caps.
Simon, have you seen Adam Lallana?
I have.
Going slightly berserk in what looks relatively sort of clumsy, if innocuous, challenge from 19-year-old George Marsh, who was a Spurs playing for Spurs under 23. And then it's a sort of wrestling move Lallana puts on him, isn't it?
Yeah, Lallana rises from the turf in, you know, full Incredible Hulk mode and goes for him big time. Seems weirdly out of character.
It does. I mean, in more than 400 career appearances, never collected a straight red or two yellows in the same game, Lallana. I suppose we don't know if he'd been targeted. Jack Wilshere got done, didn't he, in under 23 games really badly. So we've
only seen the clip and we don't really know the context. It could have been the latest in a long line of knocks and niggles by young Mr. Marsh. And it may not, I have no idea, but it did seem a strangely over-the-top reaction to a fairly innocuous aerial duel.
Mm. A three-game ban for the under-23s, but not banned in the Premier League. Does anyone think that if you commit a misdemeanour in the under-23s, it should have any impact on your whether you play in the Premier League or not?
I don't know. Are we going to then say that if you score for the under-23s, that gets added to your season tally? I don't know. I'm being facetious. I mean, I can understand why a player coming back from injury would get very angry at a bad tackle or something, but that just wasn't the case here. They were both going for a high ball. I didn't notice. Was it even a foul?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so I'm not sure why he lost the plot there.
Do you want a social media controversy of the week? There were lots of brilliant... Manchester United, great services to mark 60 years of Munich, didn't they? And there were some brilliant articles for people who hadn't learned a lot about the disaster, and speaking to fans of Manchester United who were alive then and survivors of the air crash. Jesse Lingard had to apologise for a tweet posted on his personal account just after the minute silence to commemorate the victims. He replied to someone about something completely different. He just said, look, a member of my media team inadvertently replied to a tweet this afternoon on my Twitter profile. This is the idea that players have media teams. And if you have a media team...
You have people managing these accounts. It's very often not the player.
You sort of
there's the classic, say something like, in the tweet.
Often they're the ones... Some players like don't even have their passwords. They're not trusted to have a password.
It's just a shame, isn't it?
So sorry, this somebody so sent Lingard, a tweet that happened to coincide with the minute silence, and he was then pounced upon for not being reverential enough.
Of course. Well, he was there, you know, I think.
Presumably. Yeah, okay. And it wasn't him that tweeted it, right? Well, you know, Twitter is a very angry and unforgiving place, but it's probably inappropriate, but it's hardly the crime of the century, is it?
Oh, I completely agree. I just think we want the footballers to run their own accounts because you want to find out what they're actually... It's not the whole point. You want to find out what they're like. Mendy is great because we know it's him. Peter Crouch is great. He doesn't tweet very often, but when he does, it's great. Just these
the word my that's really disconcerting. Like, if Manchester United have a media team who operate the players' social media accounts unless the players request to do it themselves, then that would be fine. But he didn't say our media team, he said mine. And he didn't say he didn't say my media assistant, he said one of my media team.
How big is Jesse Lingard's media team?
Lingard HQ somewhere.
Well, clearly he needs a big squad, a media squad, because the person who sent that tweet is surely going to be sent to play for the under 20 or, you know, do press for the under 23s or the reserves
or MySpace. Maybe he has to go down a social media channel, doesn't he? The one that really gets me is just after a game where you just have a photo of the person playing and it's like onwards and upwards, lads, hashtag Arsenal or whatever.
Well, I do enjoy watching Match of the Day, and this is, you know, they post the player tweets in the bottom right hand corner when they're doing the post-match analysis or interviews. and just having a little game of spot the media team v spot the actual player tweeting, and it's you know, alleviates the tedium of a late Saturday night sitting at home alone watching football.
And that's a lovely way to end part two. Welcome back to part three, the last part of Guardian Football Weekly for this week. Premier League fixtures this weekend. The game of the weekend is probably at Wembley. The early kickoff on Saturday, Spurs-Arsenal. We can hear from Arsene Wenger, who has been needling Spurs over the diving incidents in their game against Liverpool.
We have to get the diving out of a game. I remember there was tremendous cases here when it was the foreign players who did it. But I must say, the English players have learned very quickly and they may be the masters now.
What's your reaction to Wenger stirring the pot, saying Harry Kane is a diver and obviously Dele Alli too?
Well, the first observation I have to make is that is one of the most classic examples of the genre of excessive, sycophantic press conference laughter I've ever heard, where the hacks roar and guffaw at jokes that aren't really particularly that funny. But it was quite a waspish, catty comment, and he's probably dead right. You know, Dele Alli's been roundly criticised for diving, and he's far from the only player to have done it. I mean, it's not a recent thing. Famously, Franny Lee was known to have a tumble or two in his locker back in the day, so... Michael Owen, Steven Gerrard, there are plenty of examples. It's not a recent phenomenon among English players. And Maurizio Pochettino said during the week that it's more or less a skill and a talent, and should be lauded and encouraged. And he might have a point.
Simon?
I'm quite militant on diving.
More militant on diving than tea?
I would stamp out both,
okay,
given half a chance. But I think probably, I mean, we discussed the Sunday's penalties, or you discussed them on Monday. I think that the one where Harry Kane goes down is a midway point between foul and dive, where both goalkeeper and striker look a little bit foolish, and penalty is probably the right decision. So I wouldn't go overboard on that one. Dele Alli got punished for his. Yeah.
Lucan's been in touch to say, could Wenger play Lacazette on the left instead of Iwobi? I feel he would be better suited. And then you could play Aubameyang and Ozil and Mkhitaryan in the dream, trying to get the dream four into your three spots.
I'm not sure that Lacazette would be suited to that kind of role. I think he's a sort of a classic off-the-shoulder number nine kind of player who wants to use his pace and get in behind. I think he's going to be the full guy from Aubameyang's arrival at Arsenal, and probably Iwobi, although he's had quite a lot of criticism this season, probably last season as well, he's probably given them a bit more balance than Lacazette would in that kind of role. But it'll be interesting to see how they cope as a defensive unit, because they've had some horror shows recently, and Spurs, after a little wobble against Southampton a couple of weeks ago, at which point people were saying, you know, the next three games or so are going to define their season. They've really turned that around, you know, played Manchester United off the park and held their own against showed character against Liverpool at a ground where they've struggled in the past. Now coming into this, the last couple of seasons, they've really given Arsenal a bit of a torrid time in their home games against them, and it'll be interesting to see whether Arsenal can cope against Harry Kane, given the defensive problems that they've had recently.
Your West Ham played Simon's Watford. You've signed Patrice Evra till the end of the season. Bren asks Jacob if he's happy to see Evra at West Ham.
If Patrice Evra comes in and settles and produces something that helps West Ham stay up, then you might say that it's a good decision. But overall, it's signing a 36-year-old who hasn't played in the Premier League since 2014 and hasn't played since October for his former team, Marseille, where he was booted out for booting a fan. I don't think you've done particularly well there either. If you have to do that as the 17th richest club in the world, which West Ham are based on the Deloitte money figures that came out last month, then that just exposes the wider dysfunction that's existing at the club, which is a direct result of the board's interesting decisions in the past few transfer windows, and explains why the supporters are so annoyed, why after 4 minutes against Brighton last weekend there were chants of sack the board, which went on for basically the entire game in various forms of chant, constant accusations throughout that game of lies against David Sullivan, David Gold and Karen Brady. Having to do that a week after the transfer window when no other Premier League club is doing that just shows West Ham up for probably being the worst run club in the Premier League. And it's going to leave them, it doesn't really solve much about their pace issues at the back. They've already got an old squad, and it follows on a month or two since David Sullivan was saying that they would bring in young, energetic, fired up players in the January transfer window, not old players. And he said, we won't bring in players with 32. The best you could say is that Everett is 36. He also said they wouldn't do it in January. Well, they've done it in February, so maybe he was telling the truth. But as far as I'm aware, the players are a little bit perplexed. The current players in that squad are a bit perplexed about what's going on at the moment. They can't quite understand why they've got to this point where they're playing for a club which seems to refuse to spend money in a proper way. And already this week, although West Ham have refuted it, the story in the Daily Telegraph saying that David Moyes is very unlikely to stay past the end of the season.
So in short, Bryn, I think Jacob's delighted to see Everett West Ham. Jake says, as pointed out, you know, the back four of West Ham could be the oldest in Premier League history. I haven't done enough research, no, but Zabaleta 32, Collins 34, Evra 36, and Winston Reid a sprightly 29. Which could be an issue, couldn't it?
I mean, I suppose possibly. It's interesting that Manchester City last season felt that what was holding them back was that their fullbacks were too old and immobile, and West Ham have looked at that and thought, yeah, we'll have some of what was wrong with them.
Simon, Spurs are apparently targeting a summer bid for Decore, reported in the Mail.
Yeah.
God, Decore, Wanyama, Dembele, you wouldn't want to play against that.
Well, certainly Decore is ambitious. He doesn't see Watford as the limit of his ambitions, and he has performed sufficiently this season, I think, to attract interest from bigger clubs in the summer. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he does leave.
Lots of six-pointers. The bottom of the league is fascinating. West Brom bottom on 20, but then after them, Huddersfield on 24 and 19th, all the way up to Bournemouth on 31. Would we say now 31 points? Obviously, you need some more points, but you would say they are, odds are, barring some huge collapse from, say, Bournemouth or Everton, and you'd say Watford on 30, safe, Barry? Or is that going too far?
Probably. I mean, Huddersfield look like they're in huge trouble. They're in free fall. Three of their last four games of the season are against teams in the top six. They desperately need a win against Bournemouth. They beat Birmingham City in their cup replay. You could argue it was a game they didn't need. You could also argue just to get a win on the board against anyone in any competition just is beneficial, can't be anything but beneficial for a team in such a horrendous run of form. But you'd imagine any team currently on 30 will 12 games left will get enough points to stay up.
Everton play Palace, Stoke play Brighton, Swansea.
Think about Everton. Yeah, Everton Palace. I saw a very interesting statistic on Twitter yesterday, and I can't remember who posted it, but I nicked it for a Premier League preview. I got a bit of abuse for suggesting Sam Allardyce had absolved himself of all blame for Everton's defeat against Arsenal on Monday, but someone said he, for reasons best known to himself, left Gylfi Sigurdsson and Wayne Rooney on the bench for that game. In games those two players have started for Everton this season, played 6-1, 4-2, games where neither of them have started, played six, won none, lost five, I think. But the record with the, Everton's record with them starting and without, it's just unbelievable, the difference between them, you know, the contrast.
It's quite interesting because you sort of think that quite hard to fit them both into the same team.
I was surprised, I have to say. I hope it's not like my Stoke Monday night statistic and that it's actually correct. I didn't check it, but yeah, hopefully it's true.
On Burnley, Ollie Tucker says, can we start a petition to get Burnley to sign Shane Long or get Southampton to sign Kevin Long so we have the possibility of a commentator saying Long, Long to Long? We can't help with it, but we would be very happy if it happened. Manchester City, Leicester in the Mahrez derby. Where do we think Riyad Mahrez will be?
Behind a sofa, lying in a pool of tears and vomit.
Vomit.
Well,
he's had a cup of tea. Or something.
Yeah, probably.
A friend of mine was talking to me yesterday about she split up with her boyfriend, and as she did it, he vomited immediately.
Really?
Yeah. Sort of slightly South Park.
Wow.
Mm, he was very upset about it.
Yeah. Mm.
Where did she do it? Like, because I'm quite cowardly, so if I'm breaking up with someone, I do it in a public place.
Oh, okay. Face to face, though, still.
Yeah, usually.
Okay.
But I will do it in a public place so that they won't go completely berserk. Well, they might, but the chances of it are less than they would if it was in private or something. You know, I'm not going to get attacked with a knife or whatever. Although, you know, I'm bigging myself up here.
I was about to say.
Most women being dumped by me, I would probably consider it a mercy, a release. But, yeah, so if did your girlfriend dump this poor fellow in public and he vomited on the table?
I think so, yeah.
Ugh. Had they eaten?
Do you know what? Proof here that I didn't ask enough follow-up questions.
What was her reaction? What did she do?
See, I think if that happened, I'd then vomit. It'd be a chain reaction.
I will do some more inquiries.
Well, you didn't ask what she did at that. Are they still broken up? Or did she feel so sorry for him?
No.
You'd imagine she didn't kiss him anyway.
What, one
How
last,
long were they
one
together?
Last hurrah? I don't really know.
This is poor.
Okay. It's quite a good start to a story.
It's a great start. I need to come back. Yeah. I wasn't.
Can we get her on Monday's pod?
Oh, like Jeremy Kyle, this is what you want to take the pod to. Okay, well, I'll see what I can do. Leeds have appointed Barnsley manager Paul Heckingbottom. Barnsley say they're shocked and thoroughly disappointed. Leeds had to pay a £500,000 release clause. Always seems strange how small the manager's release clause is compared to a player, when we hold so much stock in how important a manager is and they seem to be very important.
I can't disagree with that. I'm surprised there aren't, you know, big fees for managers. I think, was it when Marco Silva didn't quite go to Everton, was it 13 million was the fee? And you don't hear about fees for managers too often. Heckingbottom weirdly had signed a new contract with Barnsley last Friday and left on Monday, I think. And it seems to have been all quite amicable with Leeds parting with Christensen. The day or two after he was sacked, he went in, had breakfast with the players and said his goodbyes and put his stuff in a cardboard box and walked out to the car park, and it was all fine. Heckingbottom has quite a big job on. Leeds are, I think, 6 or 7 points clear of or away from a playoff position, and they've three very big games coming up. Against, in no particular order, Bristol City, Sheffield United is the first one, Bristol City and Derby County were all vying for promotion. And Leeds are in something of a crisis defensively as well, a lot of it of their own making, because they've had, I think, 4 players sent off in their last 5 games. So between suspension and injury, they're going to have trouble fielding a back 4 on their next game. And that disciplinary problem is something Heckingbottom needs to sort out very quickly.
In other managerial news, David Unsworth has turned down Oxford United, and Ronald Koeman has been appointed manager of the Netherlands. This is from Toffee Tech, who says, Koeman, now the Holland coach, Martinez in Belgium. Will Unzi or Moyes take over Luxembourg to complete the Benelux bingo? So anyway, good luck to Ronald Koeman and Netherlands. In the Championship, big derby on Sunday, Aston Villa host Birmingham at midday. Villa are third, unbeaten since Boxing Day in the league. Birmingham have won their last two to climb out of the relegation places. Steve Bruce has done very well, hasn't he, at Aston Villa? And at the start of the season, I think it was all crisis, doom and gloom. So credit to him.
I'm going to be there on Sunday.
Oh.
Quite looking forward to it. Big game at both ends of the table. But Birmingham City are looking all right at the moment, but could be dragged into danger zone still. Well, they could be in the top two at the end of the weekend.
They're in trouble, I think, but are on an upward trajectory under, is it Steve Cotterill at Birmingham now? They've done very well since he took over.
In League One, Wigan Athletic owner Dave Whelan has reached an outline agreement to sell the League One club to a Hong Kong-based company whose principal business is running a hotel and casino in the Philippines called the International Entertainment Corporation, which could lead to calling the stadium the International Entertainment Stadium. And actually, Wigan doing quite well, aren't they? So that could fit. And Lincoln City will go to Wembley for the first time in their history after beating Chelsea's under-21s on penalties in the semi-final of the Chequered Trade Trophy. Yellow Ball says Lincoln City make it to Wembley for the first time in 134 years of their history. I don't expect that'll be of any interest to the pod, but had Chelsea under-21s finished their penalties better and made it to Wembley instead, what would the pod have made of this? Good for football, good for English youth football, terrible for football?
I think it would have been terrible, because Lincoln City will bring a huge crowd, and I don't think Chelsea under-21s would bring any sort of crowd whatsoever. So you want to see Wembley full or as near to full as make no difference for those finals. And I just think a Premier League's kids team in it, even if they've earned the right to be there, it's not a good look.
It doesn't seem to have been a success, this Chequered Trade Trophy move.
Mess.
Can you give any sympathy to anyone who tried to do something with a competition to make a difference, to make a change? Or was this just a terrible idea that should never have been done?
If you want to be generous, you could say that it's like good on you for trying to do something. It's not, I don't know. Chelsea perhaps stand out as the only Premier League team, aren't they, who've actually done well in this. I think mm-hmm. the other, you know, others have been, other young teams have been beaten by lower league sides. I know West Ham's youngsters got their backsides handed to them, I think, by Luton. I think they lost quite badly. Manchester City's lost as well. So, it's not been, they haven't sort of really filled them with, Chelsea, if you use Batch Y, I think maybe in one or two rounds. So there have been times when it's been exploited and they've kind of used it as a reserve assignment for where people like Adam Lallana get too worked up by innocuous challenges. But overall, I think they have tried to use it for their youngsters at times. So perhaps they might see certain positives, but I don't think there are many fans of lower league sides who would agree with it.
No, the only thing I thought when it was announced and lower league fans went crazy about it, as a lower league fan, I sort of made the point that no lower league fan at the start of the season thinks about it at all as a competition. It's just not on your radar until you probably get to the semi-finals. And then you get excited because you might have a day out at Wembley. So the whole idea that this had completely devalued a competition that was at such huge value to anyone was slightly disingenuous, I thought, because it wasn't really of any value to anyone in the first place. I had a fun day out when we lost to Blackpool years ago, 2005 or something like that.
Was Coventry won it last year? Yeah. And they brought over 40,000 to Wembley.
Yeah.
Their average attendance at the Ricoh Arena, I think, is about 6.
No, but obviously when you get to the final, it's really exciting.
Mm.
But until you almost might as well just draw two League One and League Two teams out in March and just say, you guys are off to Wembley. I mean, no one cares about the games at all when they happen. Having said that, on the balance of things, I still don't think it's the right idea to put those sides in.
The fact of the matter is the Premier League teams complain that there aren't enough opportunities for their youngsters. There are. You've got a first team. If you want to give your youngsters opportunities, put them in that. Otherwise, don't stockpile them and stop complaining.
So this was something that annoyed me about, particularly about Patrice Evra being signed, a 36-year-old being signed on a short-term basis, probably because Masuaku is out for spitting and he's got another four games left on his ban. Where's the youngster who is potentially coming in to fit to slot in there? And where's the youngster in the Chelsea? All these youngsters that Chelsea have, what? Why not use some of these guys? They clearly can play. And where was the youngster, the seventh youngster on Manchester City's bench last week against Burnley?
Did you get very angry? A lot of people got very angry about that.
Yeah, it was stupid.
Right. Do you want some VAR news?
Simon? I always want VAR news.
Have you seen this Boa Vista Aves yes. Clip? Aves 2-0 up against Boa Vista. And then they have a corner and the ball goes in the net. And the player is blatantly offside and the referee calls for the VAR and they go to the only camera the VAR can use, and I believe a Boa Vista fan has an enormous flag, a flag the size of this studio, waving it right in front of the camera. It's a bit like, did you see that video when the house, the massive thing was being building was being demolished and a guy sets up his camera, and just as the building's being demolished, a bus just parks in the way, and then the building's demolished and then the bus moves away and there's nothing there. The flag is waved, the ball's in the net, so the ref had to give the goal. But certainly my favourite bit of VAR so far. And producer Jonathan has just sent me a clip of how they celebrate goals in Paraguay. I don't know who's playing. Do you know who's playing in this game? We don't know who's playing, but I'll show you this clip of how goals are celebrated in Paraguay. Basically, a header goes in from a cross and it cuts to a girl. I presume, I'm not an expert, she's either putting some chalk up her nose or that's cocaine, Barry.
It certainly looks like she's doing a line of jazz salt.
Okay,
not that kind of goal scoring is not to be sniffed at.
Hey. Very good. I'll just finish on the subject of shouting at old referees from Smithy. Says Max, on the subject of yelling at elderly referees at Saturday football, I ran a team in a league similar to yours for 5 years. We played you once in the cup. On one Saturday, I spent the whole game yelling and abusing a referee who had no control, barely moved out the centre circle, and eventually blew for full time after 80 minutes because he was cold. I'm not joking. We lost 3-2. I complained to my club, who wrote an email to the league complaining how bad he was. On the Monday, I was listening to a podcast of a regular BBC Radio sports show when on their Saturday morning broadcast, only hours before my game, they introduced a section about the oldest qualified referee in the country, who at 84 was still going out to ref a game this afternoon. To my horror, it was the same man I'd spent the whole game abusing, who was a minor celebrity amongst local sports fans. I have never felt so ashamed. Thanks, Smithy.
I think it was on one of Danny Baker's shows. They had a story about a guy who reffed a match, I'm guessing of similar amateur quality slash status as you play. And because it was really cold and wet, he reffed it from his car and used the horn as his whistle and the indicators to show which way the decision was being given.
Oh, yeah. I've done countless phone-ins on this. Referees who've forgotten whistles, and one who used a harmonica. And one who used a metal tray and a metal spoon. And Paul Hawksby from TalkSport tells a story of a referee who at half-time went into the dressing room to go to the toilet and got locked in. So refereed the second half. It was one of those windows that doesn't open entirely, but just peering out the window and just blowing his whistle from the dressing room. You could only see sort of eight ninths of the pitch or something. So one end of the pitch he couldn't see at all. But yeah, the harmonica's great, isn't it? Hey, thanks for coming, Simon.
It's been a blast.
Great. Thanks, Jacob.
Thank you.
Thanks, Baz.
Thanks.
What sort of noise? Sorry. Barry just died. Oh, well. We'll find someone else for Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.